Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second of this series of three Robbins lectures by Olivier Blanchard about unemployment. I just want to say a few words as a representative of the Robbins family. I'm the son-in-law of Lionel Robbins, in whose honor these lectures are held every year, sometimes more than once a year. And I think you will all know that unemployment was one of the huge policy problems with which Lionel Robbins wrestled as a young professor and policymaker in the 1920s and 1930s. And Olivier has reminded me of his important book on the economic basis of class conflict. Of course, you've probably heard of his book on the Great Depression. And we thought, you know, the problem had been solved by Keynesian economics, full employment at the end of the war. And then unemployment came back to haunt us. And I'd like to recall a more recent episode in policymaking history when Richard Layard and I and other people set up the Employment Institute in 1985, when unemployment again went into double figures during Mrs. Thatcher's tenure of office. And that still exists as the Employment Policy Institute. And I wouldn't like people to think that the problem of unemployment has gone away. You might sometimes be forgiven for having this impression if you read some of the briefings that come out of Whitehall and Downing Street. And in fact, in this country, we do our figures in a very peculiar way. We only count people who claim benefit as being unemployed. The great way of getting the unemployment figures down has been to refuse to pay people benefit. In fact, the gap between the benefit claimants and people looking for work in the labor force survey, normal definition in other countries, that gap has never been higher. It's about 2 percentage points. I was just looking at the figures for the European Union countries. Britain has only the 7th lowest rate of unemployment measured by normal international criteria. So there are 6 other countries that have done better than we have. We're only in about the middle of the batting order. So I think our policymakers, as well as our students and academics, have still got quite a lot to learn about unemployment. It's still a problem in this country, and we still need to improve our understanding and our policies. Well, I'm sure we shall all be able to do that when we've heard Olivier's next 2 lectures, so I have great pleasure in calling on him to take the floor.
Thank you. So this is the title. This is the title, is it okay? The title of the second lecture, Rents, Product and Labor Market Deregulation and Unemployment. And indeed, it can be seen as an extension or a formalization of ideas that were presented by Lionel Robbins in 1937 in the Economic Basis of Class Conflicts, in which he asked, how can a group extract rents from the other groups in society by basically using its monopoly power, its bargaining power. And to a large extent, this is a return to the same issues. Let me remind you of the organization of the lectures. What I argued at the beginning of the previous one was that in order to think about the evolution of European unemployment over the last 30, 35 years, one had to think about 3 sets of factors. The first one was shocks. The second one was changes in institutions. And the third one was interactions between shocks and specific sets of institutions. And this lecture, the first one was about the shocks. This lecture is about changes in institutions and their effect on the evolution of unemployment in general, but also on the evolution of European unemployment in particular. So this is the plan of the day. when I thought about the what particular aspect I should deal with within that set of issues, effects of changes in institutions on unemployment, I actually came up with a long list of questions which are both fascinating and unanswered. If you look back at the period during which unemployment increased, you want to say, when is it that the changes in institutions, which plausibly could explain this increase in unemployment, came into play? And I mentioned this briefly yesterday, but I think the question is still very much an open one. Should we see what happened as a result of the 1950s and the 1960s leading to high growth and a generous state, and therefore the creation of programs which then later on gave rise to an increase in equilibrium unemployment, and in which case we have to understand why is it that it took more than 10 years for this time bomb to actually explode? Or is it the case that much of the damage was done later, which is as unemployment increased, the first reaction of many governments was to increase employment protection in order to try to avoid layoffs and a decrease in employment, or increase unemployment benefits in order to make the pain of unemployment smaller for those who were becoming unemployed. So how much of the buildup in institutions goes back to just after the war, the 1960s, the 1970s, I think remains a very, very important issue, and one where both because of conceptual difficulties, but mostly because of a lack of empirical work, we do not have a good answer. Then you have the same set of questions on the downside, which is if you look at the countries where unemployment has decreased, is it the case that unemployment has decreased because the shocks have been right, which was a bit the theme of the lecture yesterday, wage moderation, coming not specifically for changes in institutions, but leading to a lower wage and a virtuous circle? Or can we identify changes in institutions going the right way, quote-unquote, which could contribute to this decline in unemployment? And this is a topic which we actually touched upon after the formal lecture yesterday in the brief interaction triggered by a question between Richard and I. The question is, in the Netherlands, a number of policies have been taken in order, in particular, to force the unemployed back into jobs. Programs not unlike the New Deal programs which have been put in this country. And the question is how much of the decrease in unemployment can be explained by these measures. So there is basically two sets of issues, what happened on the way up and what is happening on the way down. In the end, I decided there was one issue I wanted to understand which was interesting both for itself and to shed light on what has happened to European unemployment in the recent past, which is the whole issue of the macroeconomic effects of product and labor market regulation, but also, with a minus sign, of product and labor market deregulation. We know that this is coming. We know that there's a great deal of product market deregulation happening. We think that there has been some labor market deregulation and more is to come. We have left much of the thinking to microeconomists, to people who look at the structure of markets. We've not been very good at trying to understand the implications for macroeconomics, and in particular for unemployment. And I thought this would be something worth thinking about. And in addition, I think that not only is it of interest in itself, but it sheds light on a specific set of facts. So let me show you one of the two figures which in this lecture I find extremely interesting. And this plots for the four continental European countries the evolution of unemployment rates and the evolution of labor shares from 1970 to roughly 2000, 98, 99, 100 for unemployment. So let me start with the bottom graph, which I first discovered a few years back, and I've struggled very hard to give an interpretation to. This is the evolution of the labor share in the private sector, in the business sector, as a ratio to value added in the sector. So it excludes the government. There are issues of construction when you do this, which is how you treat self-employment. And here the convention is to attribute a wage to the self-employed equal to the wage in the rest of the private sector and call the rest profit or capital income. And so you add the imputed wage of the self-employed to the other wages and you have the labor share. I think the evolutions which are in this figure are very much robust. I know that they are very much robust to the type of statistical questions that you might have about the construction of labor share. And I think that this picture is very, very surprising. The first half, if you go in time from 1970, is not very surprising, which is that if you look at the various countries, the hard line is France. Given that I know most about France, I tend to identify it in my graph, so I know exactly what happened. But you can see that the evolution is largely common. What you see is in the 70s, you see an increase in the labor share from the level of the 1970s. 1970. Before that, we really do not have very good data, but it was more or less flat, as far as we can tell. And that's no great surprise. It relates to the themes that we talked about yesterday, that when wages kept increasing and although employment was decreasing, was not decreasing fast enough, so the labor share, which is the product of the two, kept increasing. So you had an increase in the labor share, which in many countries peaked in the early 80s, in France in the early 80s. And then from the early 80s, as one might have expected, workers understood that wage growth was too high. This was one of the themes that we explored yesterday. They started cutting wages. This led to a decrease in the labor shares. Employment did not react right away. So that by 1985, mid-80s, basically we were back in most countries to the same level of the labor share as we had been in 1970, and apparently, given the data we have, for most of the post-war period. That seemed normal, but is very much what we would have expected. The dramatic event is that it kept going, and the labor share continued to decline throughout the 80s and through a good part of the 1990s to levels which are incredibly lower than the labor share at the peak, but also substantially lower than the historical average, which is roughly the 1970 value. Right? If you look at France, you had a labor share of 70% of GDP. The labor share is now less than 60% of GDP. A change of 10% of GDP is a gigantic number in terms of the distribution of factor income. And from the top, it is a decrease of nearly 14%. So this gives the notion that something very dramatic happened, maybe enormous wage moderation leading to a large decline in wages and not offset by corresponding increase in employment, but something very major happened here. And that's a graph that many of you probably have never seen, but in terms of big changes, big macroeconomic changes of the last 30 years, this is a very important phenomena and something very different from anything we had seen earlier, at least in historical statistical history. Now, based on the kind of reasoning that I went through yesterday, although this is a bit fuzzy at this point, the argument might have been, well, that if the labor share is going down so much, this wage moderation should be leading to an increase in employment. Now, it sounds like the labor share is not the real wage, but you tend to think it's related to it, and we would have expected the unemployment rate to basically follow suit, which is employment to start increasing and unemployment to start decreasing. And basically, on net, for most of the 80s, surely, and even for most of the 90s, unemployment remained very, very high. It is only in the last two or three years that unemployment has started decreasing in a number of these countries. The decrease has been especially dramatic in Spain, but it is now visible, I think, in all four countries, Italy being the laggard. So I saw this as a major macroeconomic puzzle, which is, well, there is a puzzle in itself, which is how do we think about this event? And then if we give the second puzzle, is if we give a natural interpretation, which is wage moderation leading to a lower labor share, then how is it that unemployment remained high in the 90s? And so this is very much the motivation for this lecture and for the line of work that I want to present. So let me tell you where I'm going, although the next slide will give you the organization. You have these facts. The first thing you do is you go back to your neoclassical model, the type of model that I talked about yesterday, and you say, are there combinations of dynamics, elasticities of substitution between factors which are going to generate this? Is it in fact not a puzzle if I look at my neoclassical model right? And I came to the conclusion, which I'll try to share with you later, that in fact it is a major puzzle. In terms of the models that we saw yesterday, that fact is not easy to explain. So yesterday I was pushing the line that we could go a long way, but I insisted that we could not go all the way. That's exactly where we cannot go, which is that particular fact, the evolution of wages, labor shares, and unemployment in the 90s, is not easily explainable in terms of the framework we were thinking of yesterday. So this suggests going away from a strict neoclassical model in which factors are paid their marginal product, but think in terms of an economy in which there are rents, and there is bargaining over these rents. And then the natural intuition for what happened is basically that some of the rents were transferred from workers to firms. At a very intuitive level, that's one way of thinking about what happened to the labor share. The workers had rents, and the firms were able to appropriate them, so the profit share went up, the labor share went down. And this is what happened. The question is, can we basically formalize this story? And when I thought about it, I thought, well, what may have happened over the last 15 years which could explain this shift in rents? And I came to the conclusion that product and labor market deregulation might well be part of the story. So what this lecture does is basically think about a model which is richer than the one yesterday, in which there are rents, there is bargaining. Within that context, think about product and labor market regulation and deregulation, and then argue that this provides a fairly natural interpretation of the facts. And if you accept that, then you can think about the future, and the future is relatively bright in terms of unemployment. So that the bottom line in terms of forecasting the future is that although we have seen effects which were not incredibly favorable to workers, a decrease in the share, no decrease in unemployment, the future should be brighter. And that's what I want to end the lecture with. Okay? So that's, in a nutshell, what we're going to do. I realize that I've already covered some of these points. This describes the organization of a written lecture. Let me just go through it very quickly because I think I've already sketched it. What I want to do is, as in the previous lecture, there's the same question, the simple for sure, the simplest question mark model that we need to think about these issues. And it's clear that in this case we need two components. The first one is we need to generate an economy in which there are rents, namely a non-competitive economy, otherwise there would not be rents. And so what is the easiest way of doing this is basically to give firms monopoly power in the goods market. So to think of a goods market as a monopolistically competitive goods market in which firms have rents. So this creates the rents, and then we need another ingredient, which is bargaining over the rents between the workers and the firms. And so instead of having just labor supply, labor demand, or wage setting and labor demand in the labor market, I'm going to have bargaining in the labor market over employment and wages. So the model is going to have two components and nothing else, and the rest will be identities and general equilibrium conditions. It will have monopolistic competition in the goods market, and it will have bargaining over employment and wages in the labor market. So a lot of time in this particular lecture, I will have to spend some time showing the structure of the model. I think the model is conceptually as simple as the model yesterday, except that it is less familiar, because we have not, at least I had not thought in those terms to think about the general equilibrium, and therefore I'll go a bit more slowly than yesterday. Having done this, I will then look at the effect of deregulation. I will show what dynamic effects it has on this economy, Having done this, I'll go back to the data, argue that if you look at the data through the filter of this mole, it smells like deregulation, and it may be with deregulation. And then I will end by saying, well, suppose you don't believe my story, what are alternative interpretations? And I'll try to convince you that the alternative interpretations are less convincing than this one. Okay. I've again succeeded in meeting the same constraint as yesterday, which has to have them all on one page. I had to use a slightly smaller font. And I apologize, the cost will be borne by the people in the rows that back there, but I succeeded. So the point is that the mole is actually quite simple, and that's the inter. So the way to think about this economy is at any point in time, in the goods market, there are N firms. And at any point in time, the number of firms is given. Over time, the number of firms will adjust as a function of entry or exit by firms. But think of the economy at one point in time, there are N firms. And each firm, so-called this firm I, is facing these conditions. Okay. It is facing a demand for its product, YI, which is equal to the total demand for the products, Y, divided by the number of firms, N, okay, times a term which depends on its relative price. So given that D of 1 is equal to 1, this would be equal to 1. If it charges the same price as the others, then it gets 1nth of total demand. Okay? And otherwise, if it decides to choose a price to choose a price which is higher than the price level, so relative price greater than 1, it will sell less. And if it chooses a price lower, it will sell more. So this is a perfectly conventional demand function for the firm. The important assumption is that the elasticity of the demand faced by a given firm is given by sigma. The sigma is the elasticity of demand, and is a function of a parameter sigma bar, to which I shall return, but which is a parameter, and an increasing function of the number of firms. That's an important assumption because it builds in the way an increase in the number of firms is going to affect the economy, namely by increasing competition. The more firms there are in the economy, the more products, the more substitutable each product is for the other, and therefore the higher the elasticity of substitution between products, therefore the more elastic the demand for goods. Okay. So in the limit here, if the number of firms goes to infinity, then the elasticity faced by each firm becomes infinite, and you go back to competition. Okay. So this is going to be one of the mechanisms. It's going to be the mechanism in this economy through which higher competition, more firms, does good things. It's going to tilt the demand faced by each firm, reduce its monopoly power, and this will play an important role. So this is the demand curve. The firm then faces a production function which is about as simple as can be, which is that it uses one unit of labor, one person, in order to produce one unit of output. The major simplification here is that there is no capital. I do this just for simplicity. The written lecture actually eventually expands the mole to have capital in, make it much more like the mole we had yesterday. But here the decision is just to leave this aside. There are going to be dynamics, but they are not going to come from capital. They are going to come from entry and exit of firms. Okay. So productivity here is always going to be 1. Yi over Ni is equal to 1. And there'll be no effect of competition of productivity, which is one other channel you might have wanted to have, which I don't have in this one. So demand, production. Now, it is employing workers. Workers could be doing something else, and therefore they have a reservation wage. And this is very much like the black box we had yesterday, except with a different notation. This is the wage at which they would be willing to work is a function of a parameter B and a decreasing function of the unemployment rate. So the higher unemployment, the lower the reservation wage at which workers are willing to work. Right? Unemployment depresses the reservation wage of workers. B is a parameter. I'll think of it as influenced by regulation in the labor market. But you can think of this as unemployment benefits. It's anything which makes it more attractive not to work. to be unemployed. Okay. These are the four assumptions about taste preferences. Now the question is, how does the firm and the workers choose employment, the wage, and once they have chosen employment, it determines output, it determines the relative price. And here I assume Nash bargaining, or the assumption if you've taken a labor course called efficient bargaining, in which they choose separately the wage and employment. And what they do is that they choose, so the workers care about the surplus from work, which is the number of workers, times the wage minus the reservation wage. The firm cares about profit, which is relative price times output, minus the real wage times employment. Okay. The weight of workers in bargaining is beta, which is between 0 and 1. The weight of the firm is 1 minus beta. So the stronger the workers in bargaining, the higher beta, the more they'll get of the total surplus. Let me say something here which will be understood by those of you who have taken a labor course, it may not by the others. There are many ways of formalizing the choice of employment and wages when the firms and when the firm and the workers are bargaining. This has the characteristic that it divorces the choice of the wage from the choice of employment. What happens here with efficient bargaining is that the employment level will be chosen so as to maximize the total surplus to the firm and the workers. So the marginal revenue product will just be equal to the reservation wage. And this will determine employment. Okay. Given that level of employment, that level of output, there'll be rents. And the wage will split the rents between the workers and the firm. But the wage may change because beta, for example, has changed. The level of employment will remain the same. So in a framework like this, employment and the wage are not going to be on the labor demand curve. In particular, the workers are going to be able to get more employment at a given wage than they would get if the firm was operating on the labor demand curve. This was a parenthesis for those of you who have seen these issues in labor economics. But otherwise, I would argue that this is absolutely standard framework. Even this assumption is very standard. In the short run, the number of firms is given, and we just have to put general equilibrium conditions and solve. We'll do this in a minute. In the long run, I assume that firms can exit and enter. What does it depend on? Well, it depends on the amount of profit that they are making. I make an assumption which is not the standard one in the monopolistic competition literature, which is a fixed cost of entry. I first assume that the cost is a shadow cost because I want to think of it as the restrictions on entry which are put by legal restrictions. So this is not actually something that firms have to pay, but only some firms are allowed in, and therefore there's a shadow cost of entry which sustains this equilibrium. And then for technical reasons, rather than having a fixed cost of entry per firm, I have a cost of entry which is proportional to the amount of output produced. This has the implication of simplifying the math, and if it comes up in the questions later, I will argue that it doesn't change anything about the conclusions that I want to. This is the model. In that model, there are four parameters that you can think of as summarizing regulation in the product market and regulation in the labor market. And the goal of the exercise will be to characterize the equilibrium and then move these parameters and see what happens. So I think of product market regulation as having two dimensions. The first one is affected sigma bar, which is the for a given number of firms, elasticity between products. So for example, measures which lead to a more integrated European market, homogenize the products so that they can be sold in Germany and in France, are basically increases in sigma bar. It increases competition between existing products because it makes them more the same. Where before that, they were difficult. German cars could not be used in France. French cars could not be used in Germany. So this would be an example of an increase in sigma bar. And then C is the cost of entry, and I think here of all the restrictions on entry which are put by various governments, various countries, and a decrease in C just makes it easier for a new firm to come in and therefore is likely to increase competition. So these are the two parameters characterizing product market regulation. There are two parameters characterizing labor market regulation. 1B, which you can think of as unemployment benefits, which is probably more than that, which determines the reservation wage. So the higher the reservation wage, the more the firm will have to pay the workers, in effect. And then the other, which I'm going to spend much time thinking about, is beta, which is the relative bargaining power of workers relative to firms, which is also affected by all kinds of measures, from closed shop, from extension agreements, from all the measures which basically determine the outcome of bargaining. So what I now want to do, this was the hard part, what I now want to do is characterize the equilibrium of this, and this will be, I think, quite intuitive, and then look at the effect of changes in two of these parameters, not the four because of time constraints. Okay. I'm going to proceed in three steps to characterize the equilibrium. And all three steps are going to be graphical. And at each point, I'll basically emphasize what it is that I think you should remember. So here we're looking at one firm, firm I, and how it's going to decide about employment, output, price, and wage. Okay. So what you have is the firm faces the downward sloping demand curve DD. It faces a downward sloping marginal revenue product curve. This is a standard monopolist problem. What is the shadow cost of production? Well, given that production is one unit of input requires one worker, it is just the reservation wage of worker, so that the marginal cost, in effect, is flat and equal to B times F of U. So this is the marginal cost curve. Okay? Now, what is efficient to do, and what is going to be the outcome of efficient bargaining? What is, from the point of view of the workers and the firms taken together, the efficient thing to do, it is to equalize the marginal revenue product to the reservation rate, to the marginal cost, and therefore to choose this level of employment. And so the firm, collectively with workers, is going to choose this level of employment, which is the one which maximizes total rents for the firm and the workers taken together. So it's going to choose this, which means that it will choose a price equal to pi over p, which is on the demand curve, and quite conventionally, what's going to happen is that this price is going to be equal to marginal cost, which is B times F of U, times a markup, 1 plus mu, where mu is equal in conventional fashion as 1 over the elasticity minus 1. So the lower the elasticity, the higher the markup. This is, at this stage, very much a monopoly problem, except that the marginal cost is the reservation wage of workers. So it will take the employment decision this way. And therefore, the whole rents will be this square, this rectangle, right? And the bargaining over the wage is going to be how much of the rents go to the workers, how much of the rents go to the firm. If the workers had no bargaining power, then they would just get that, and the firm would get all of it. In general, given that the firms have bargaining power, they are going to get 1 plus beta mu times B of F of U, which is a weighted average of these two, with weight beta on this one. Okay. So the stronger the workers in bargaining, it will have no effect on employment, but it will increase the wage that workers get. That's simple. There are already two implications I want you to think about, which is in partial equilibrium, workers are going to like product market regulation. Product market regulation means a lower elasticity of substitution, a larger markup for their firm, and therefore larger rents, and therefore a larger wage, right? If the firm gets more monopoly profits and you get some of it, then you're all in favor of more monopoly profits. So you actually want product market regulation for your firm. This will increase your wage, as you can see from here, okay? And then the other is a higher degree of bargaining power, a higher beta, is going to lead to a higher wage, but without any implications for employment, because the employment decision will basically be taken efficiently. So you're just going to get more of the rents, but without any adverse effect on employment. So from the point of view of workers, in partial equilibrium, more product market regulation, stronger labor market regulation in the sense of a higher beta, will be good. Okay. There's a remark here about if utility is concave, which I'm going to pass again because of time constraints. But this is very much from the point of view of just one firm taking the rest of the economy as given. And if you go back to the previous graph, you'll see that in general, PI over P that the firm chooses, the relative price that it chooses, has no reason to be equal to 1. When we go to general equilibrium, it cannot be that all firms choose PI over P equal to 2. It cannot be that each price is twice the average, right? So the general equilibrium constraint is that the relative price of each firm, here there's complete symmetry, must be equal to 1. That's the general equilibrium constraint. Nobody can charge a price higher than the others. Not everybody can charge a price higher than the others. So the general equilibrium model is very much the same. We can still look at the firm, but with an additional constraint, which is that PI over P must be equal to, there's an equal sign missing. I don't think we have anything to, it's written here correctly. Okay, there's an equal sign missing. In general equilibrium, the relative price of the firm must be equal to 1. Now remember how each firm prices. It basically takes the reservation wage, multiplies by a markup. That has to be equal to 1. So what has to give? Well, the reservation wage of workers. Basically, the reservation wage of workers must be such that once it has been marked up, it's equal to 1. And so this is the equation which comes out, which basically determines unemployment. Right? The level of unemployment must be such as to generate a reservation wage low enough that once it has been marked up, the price that firms choose is equal to 1. Okay? So this has the implication that the larger markup, the lower the reservation wage, and therefore the higher the equilibrium level of unemployment. So that's the first implication that one gets. The second implication is that the wage is still going to be a weighted average of 1 PI over P, which now is equal to 1, and the reservation wage, which is 1 over 1 plus mu, and therefore the wage is going to be given by this formula. Right. The reservation wage B of F of U has disappeared because of this relation. So this is a bit fast, but let me now just try to show your intuition a bit more, which is we know in general equilibrium what are the implications of product market regulation and labor market regulation for workers. Now, the higher the degree of product market regulation, the higher the degree of monopoly power, the higher unemployment will be. And the reason is that if firms mark up a reservation wage by more, reservation wage has to be lower, unemployment has to be lower. So now, an increase in mu, more product market regulation, is actually bad for workers in terms of unemployment. The second result is also interesting because it is just the opposite of the result we got in partial equilibrium, which is that higher monopoly power, higher mu, leads to a lower real wage in general equilibrium. You can see it from here. An increase in mu increases the denominator by 1, increases the numerator by only beta. And the reason there is that in partial equilibrium, there was one effect, which is when there's more product market regulation, the price of the good you produce goes up, your rents go up. But in general equilibrium, everybody does that. And therefore, the prices of all the other products increase as well. And so although you gain as worker, you lose as consumers because you're buying now more expensive products everywhere else. What you gain is only beta of the rents in your firm. What you lose is the full increase in the price in other firms. So product market regulation is good in from a partial equilibrium point of view, but it's bad in general equilibrium point of view because the level of prices increases and your wage comes down. Now, it remains true that in the short run in general equilibrium, if you can increase your bargaining power as workers, you're able to increase a higher wage, you get a higher wage, this goes up, and you have no effect on unemployment. So we now have a different light, which is product market regulation is not so good from the point of view of workers. Labor market regulation is good in the sense it gives you a higher wage, you get more of a rent, and no effect on unemployment. One last step, and then we'll be able to get back to the issues. All we have done until now was that was based on a given number of firms in the economy, N. So what's going to happen over time, and the difference between the short run and the long run, is if the profit per unit is the profit per worker is less than C, then some firms will have to get out. As the number of firms decreases, competition will decrease, monopoly power will increase, profits will be reestablished. If instead the profit per worker is greater than C, we'll get the opposite effect, in which profit per worker will be large, firms will enter, there'll be more competition, this will put pressure on markups, this will decrease profit. And so what we get in the long run is a condition on the number of firms, which is just such that the profit per worker is equal to the entry cost, the shadow cost, and that determines the number of firms. So that's the long-run condition. Now, this takes this form, which is that the profit per worker must be equal to C, which you can solve to get this. This gives you an equation which says that in the long run, the number of firms, and therefore the degree of competitiveness of the economy, depends on two parameters. The first one is beta, and the other one is C. And it is important here, I think, to understand what happens. If beta is larger, then for a given total rents, what the firms get is smaller. And therefore, less firms will be able to survive in that market. There'll be less competition. If C is higher, then the profit rate has to be higher in order to match this higher value of C. And this will be achieved by a reduction in the number of firms and a decrease in competition. And so that's why you get these two relations. Okay. So you get the result that the unemployment rate in the long run is going to depend on these two parameters because they determine the number of firms, which is the higher cost of entry is going to lead to less firms, a larger markup, a higher unemployment rate, more appropriation of rents by workers in the short run, which is good for them in the short run, will lead to less firms, will lead therefore to less competition, will lead to higher unemployment in the long run. And the wage will always be equal just to this, which is 1, which is the marginal product, minus what you have in effect to pay capital or to pay the entry cost, which is C, 1 minus C, independent of all the parameters. Okay. So this was much too fast, but I hope what I have given you is a way of thinking about how the general equilibrium of an economy with rents and bargaining can look like and the effects of regulation. But now what I want to do is basically go through deregulation in a bit more detail, and then I'll be ready to go back to the data. Okay. At this stage, one could write a boring paper, or give a boring talk by looking at, you know, an increase in each of the four parameters and a decrease in each of the four parameters. What I'm going to do, because I have in mind what I want to explain, which are the facts I showed you earlier, I'm going to focus on deregulation, and I'm going to focus on two parameters, not four. A decrease in C and a decrease in beta. So the question is, what happens in an economy if we take measures so that it becomes easier to enter the markets? You decrease C, you decrease the shadow cost. Okay. What we get is fairly straightforward. Here I'm going to build on what I've said, but I hope it is also self-contained. In the short run, by assumption, the number of firms is fixed. So when you do product market deregulation, if it's going to work through entry, it's going to take some time before you see the effect. So nothing happens in the short run. In the long run, as you decrease the cost of entry, you're going to increase the number of firms. You're going to increase competition. You're going to decrease the markup. And therefore, you're going to decrease unemployment and increase the real wage. Okay. So the effects are going to be beneficial to workers in both ways, namely lower unemployment, okay, and a higher real wage. What will happen to the labor share, and I'm going back because this is the fact I gave you, well, in this model, the real wage and the labor share are the same because the productivity of labor is one. So the two move together. But if I had a model in which this was not true, it would still be the case that if we have major product market deregulation, what is likely to happen is a decrease in unemployment and an increase in the labor share. And the reason is basically the monopoly rents are reduced. More of it goes to workers. I think that's what I want you to remember. Now, if I look at the labor market deregulation, a decrease in beta, so workers become weaker in bargaining, then what happens in the short run? Well, if you go back to what we have seen, in the short run, basically what's going to happen is that they're going to accept a lower wage, they're going to get less of the rents, but it is going to have no effect on employment, no effect on unemployment. So initially, what's going to happen is we're going to see the wage come down, but employment or unemployment is not going to change. Indeed, and this is the remark which I didn't go into, I just mentioned that for those of you who have seen these models, if workers were not risk neutral, we would get an even stronger result, which is that when there is deregulation of the labor market in this sense, then what we're going to see is a decrease in the real wage, as we have here, but also a decrease in employment, which is weaker workers actually get a lower real wage and a lower level of employment. So in the short run, what we would see would be a lower real wage, a lower labor share, and an increase in employment. That basically is what weaker workers in bargaining would deliver. Okay? In the long run, things are much better for workers because what happens is the fact that beta is smaller means that the profits that firms make and keep is larger, so there's an increase in the number of firms, and in the long run, this leads to more competition, lower unemployment, and the wage goes back to where it was at the beginning, 1 minus C, as we saw before. So the short of it is product market deregulation is likely to happen more slowly because it happens through entry. It's likely to lead to lower unemployment, which is good, but and an increase in the wage in the labor share. Labor market deregulation is likely to start with a decrease in employment or no change in employment and a decrease in the labor share, and then later on basically lead to an increase in profits and so on. So realizing that all this is too fast, but that you got the essence of it, back to the facts that I've talked about. Let me first say that I'm using here this model to look at deregulation because the topic of these lectures is the evolution of European unemployment. I think this is a very rich model for all kinds of political economy questions. And that comes from the fact that the way workers see things in partial equilibrium is not the same as they see things in general equilibrium. What happens in short run equilibrium is not the same as long run. But there are very rich interactions between returns to increasing beta, workers getting more unionized, depending on the structure of labor market. So interactions between product market regulation and labor market regulation. And I think the structure is a very nice one to play with. But leave this aside, go back to Europe in the 1980s and after, and you can see, I basically have done all the work here, which is that, remember the data, there has been a large decrease in the labor share, no decrease in unemployment, or even perhaps an increase. You go back, there is one change in the model which is going to deliver this, which is labor market deregulation, weaker workers in bargaining. So one interpretation is that starting in the mid-1980s, workers became weaker in bargaining. And so they basically gave up wage, they made wage concessions without getting anything in the form of employment increases. And indeed, in many cases, the reduction in wages came with additional layoffs, which the firms felt that they could actually get away with and they had not been able to do before. So the initial phase was indeed what we saw, which is a decrease in the labor share as well as no obvious good effect on unemployment. Now, the good news is if this is right, then the future should be very bright, which is that the profit rates have indeed been higher as a result of this. We saw that yesterday, but it's true in general. We saw it for two countries. And therefore, what should happen over time is that there's going to be more profit, more investment, more firms, more competition, and in the long run, we'll get beneficial effects from all this and the labor share will go back to normal. The question is how long it takes. That's an empirical question. If we look at the data this way, it looks as if it has taken a long time and we may only now be seeing the effect on profit, on higher competition. Remember that something else has happened, which we talked about yesterday, which is interest rates went up at the same time the profit rate was going up, so that this effect was probably delayed by something. But my conclusion here is that this model provides one interpretation of the data, which is very different from the ones we were looking at in the previous lecture, which is workers becoming weaker in bargaining, paying a cost, which eventually should lead to more benefits, but we haven't seen these benefits yet. Okay. The rest of the paper and the rest of the lecture is to say, well, fine, that may work. Are there other explanations of what has happened which would be less exotic, more neoclassical? And what I do in the paper, and I'm going to try to do here, is basically go through a number of them and argue that they are not very convincing. So I'm now going to do what I should probably have started with in logical terms, which is we had a mall yesterday. Can this mall deliver? And here there are two stories. The first one is that what happened is that there was this very large wage push in the 1970s because of a slowdown in TFP growth, things we talked about. And initially, it led to an increase in the labor share because the elasticity of substitution between capital and labor was low, so firms had no choice. They had to employ the same amount of labor at a higher wage. But what has happened over time is that they have moved away from labor, and the long-run elasticity of substitution is very high. It just takes a very long time to see it. So that what we saw in the 80s and the 90s is basically the reaction to the wage push of the 70s, but with very long lags because it's complicated to change production. There are pretty clear elements. The technology is fixed. You can't do it very quickly. The problem with this explanation, just prima facie, is that firms should not be acting on the basis of what happened 30 years ago, but on the basis of what they expect in the future. And if it is indeed the case that the wages were too high then, they are now much lower than they were then. And looking forward, there is no reason to keep going away from labor, and firms should not be reacting to the past, but to the expected future. There is another story which is just the opposite, which says, well, what happened is, yes, there was this wage push, but when wages went down relative to yesterday, technological progress, and so what happened is wages are very low. And the elasticity of substitution is not very high as here, but very, very low. So now we have low wages, and firms have not shifted very much towards employment because it's very difficult to shift back. So this is just the opposite argument based on a very low elasticity of substitution. That explanation is not terribly convincing because although the empirical evidence is that the long-run elasticity of substitution may be high, we know that over a period of 10 years, which is what we need here, the elasticity of substitution is not very low. A number less than 1 is highly implausible. Much less than 1 is highly implausible. So it is unlikely that this explanation would do the trick. I want to show you one graph which makes, I think, these points in a just a bit more complicated way, but a much more convincing way. And I hope you can see it in the back. This is a graph which I could have put yesterday, which comes very much from the logic of the model yesterday, which is suppose that we're in a neoclassical world, and that's a null hypothesis. In that world, there should be a close relation between the ratio of labor and efficiency units, An over K, and the wage inefficiency units. In other words, there should be a good labor-demand relation, just adjusting for technological progress. In the mall yesterday, there was a simple relation between the two. So what we can do is plot each one. We can construct A. We did it yesterday. We can plot each one and see what happens. And I would argue that the picture is rather similar over the four countries. I'm going to look at the one I know best, which is this one. And so what you see here is the first half of the story, which fits very much what I was telling yesterday, which is in France, starting in 1970, you see a large increase in the ratio of W to A, which is wages increase faster than technological progress. This was the argument yesterday, slow down in TFP growth, workers don't understand, so the wages become too high. So wages become too high. What would we expect firms to do? We would expect firms to move away from labor, to decrease labor given capital, and so the labor to capital ratio to go down. And that's exactly what you see, right? So basically you see this movement, which is exactly what you would expect under standard neoclassical theory. The factor is more expensive, you use less of it. Okay? But it's what happens after, which doesn't fit the story at all, and in this diagram and in the others, which is that starting in the early 80s, and surely being entirely done by the late 80s, the wage in France, we start seeing wage moderation. Not on the scale of Ireland and the Netherlands yesterday, but we see some. So that by 1990, roughly, the wage is back to where it was in 1970. In other words, the slowdown in TFP growth has been absorbed. Now wages are at the same level as they were then, adjusted for the level of technology. What you see, however, is that instead of returning all the way to the previous level of employment to capital, you see some increase, but not at all as much, which is that although the wage is now back to where it was, the employment to capital ratio is much lower than it was. This mechanically creates a decrease in the labor share, right? The wage is back to where it was, the employment is lower, and therefore the labor share is lower. That's just another way of looking at it. And what you see is that although since then, the wage in France has remained lower than it was in 1970, adjusted for the level of technology, French firms have not returned back to the employment capital ratio that they had in 1970. So it looks as if they have decreased employment at a given wage, or it would decrease the wage at a given level of employment. And that's very hard to reconcile with a standard neoclassical story. So I think that shows that there has been a shift. And it gives, I think, some support for the type of theory I've developed. Let me use 5 minutes, yes, given indeed. That we... Let me mention other explanations. At least I'll talk about this one. I may not talk about this one. There's an alternative story. Here, the formalization has been to say that there was efficient bargaining. There was privately efficient bargaining. And although BETA was changing, the outcome of bargaining was different, but it was efficient before and after. There's another story which says that basically Europe in the early 80s was actually using labor inefficiently, that there was labor hoarding, that the unions had been able to force firms to hire too many workers so that at a given wage, the marginal product of the marginal worker was lower, was lower than its wage. Okay. So this would be a different story because it would say this is inefficient, but workers had been able to boost employment at a given wage. Okay. And then what happened over time is that the firms, being stronger, were able to get rid of labor hoarding, were able to shed labor, and therefore get to a point closer to their labor demand curve, namely eliminate some of the excess employment that was in the firms. This would have very much the same implications as the ones I have described, which is that basically workers are weaker and they get hit in two ways. The first is that they get lower wages and some labor is basically laid off because labor shedding is eliminated. So the formal model is a bit different because we now go from an inefficient outcome to something which may be more efficient. But the outcome is very much the same. And in terms of description of reality, this strikes me as a very plausible story, a period of layoffs and wage moderation. There is a twist, which I'll mention, and again, will probably be better understood by those of you who have seen these models before, which is that in the case of efficient bargaining, you agree on a wage, you agree on a level of employment. Once you have agreed, it is what we call timing consistent for the firm, in the sense that at the given wage, the firm would like to cheat and employ less people. Right. It is efficient, but the firm ex post would like to do this. Now, there are many reasons why firms may not want to do this most of the time, because if they do this, workers are going to be mad. Next time there is renegotiation, the workers are going to be very unhappy. But you can think of circumstances in which they are going to be willing to pay the long-run cost of having very unhappy workers in order to increase profits in the short run. So if there's an increase in product market competition, it may be that all these implicit promises you had made to your workers, you're basically willing to give up, reduce employment, knowing that workers will be mad later, but making more profit in the short run. That's a story which doesn't strike me also as totally implausible, which is that faced with more competition, firms basically decided to reduce employment relative to the implicit contracts that they had made with workers. If this is the case, then the outcome is a bit different in the sense that we move from an efficient outcome to an inefficient outcome. Workers are going to be very pissed when they renegotiate, and the outcome is a bit different in the long run. But these are variations, I think, on the same general theme, weaker workers, lower wages, and so on. This I'll pass because of time. Let me just mention these two issues. I've made very much the argument in a Friedmanite way, which is I've said, look, there are facts to be explained. Here's a theory. But as most of these theories are, you can actually go back and try to find direct evidence on deregulation. And the question is, do we see a lot of labor market deregulation, institutional deregulation, since the mid-80s? And do we see little product market deregulation? I think the answer here is no. If we actually look at institutional change, it goes very much against me. There has been much more product market deregulation within the EU developments when there has been labor market deregulation. The institutional labor market deregulation has been much more case by case, much more in each country. Is this deadly? I don't think so, because what I have in mind is a decrease in beta, and the decrease in beta may not be due to institutional changes. I mean, basically, there's an argument that unions or workers have become weaker in bargaining, and this may happen without institutional change. And what we know, for example, is that the unionization rate in now all countries of Europe, even now the Scandinavian countries, has gone down quite a bit, making unions weaker. So that's prima facie evidence that unions are weaker and that the decrease in beta is plausible. This leads to the last question, which I'll ask you the question, which is, why is it that unions have become weaker? I think part of it is a change in the way we think about economics and macroeconomics and the role of wage setting. But it may also be the anticipation of product market deregulation, which is that the reason for being, for one of the reasons for being for unions is basically that there are rents which come from the product market that by bargaining you can get. Now, if suddenly these rents go away, or you anticipate them to go away, then there is not much point in being unionized, because basically there are no rents to be extracted. So here you can tell a story which is a combination of the anticipation of much higher competition in the goods market leading unions to be weaker, and therefore these results to emerge. The bottom line, this compared to yesterday, say, well, you need probably to take into account these complications, these rents, this bargaining. And if you want to get the complete story of unemployment in Europe over the last 30 years, for the last 10, this element, maybe changes in institutions, may be quite important.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure we'd all want to compliment Olivier both on the elegance and simplicity of his theoretical models and on their close applicability. Intuitively, they seem to apply so very much to so many disparate phenomena which we haven't been able to explain too well up to now. I'm sure there'll be some questions. Who would like to start off? Well, perhaps I could start off by putting a sort of puzzle that's been developing in my mind, which is that very often firms justify a degree of monopoly by reference to the fact that they need the monopoly rents in order to develop new technologies, new investments in a state of pure competition. They wouldn't have a surplus to invest, and you wouldn't get the new technology, the rise in productivity. And as I remember from your models yesterday, a great deal of the success of places like the Netherlands and Ireland was precisely in the fact that productivity was able to move ahead of wages, and thus you got a sort of virtuous spiral in economic growth. So could there be a danger perhaps in pushing product market deregulation too far? Would that be bad for the economy? I'm thinking of pharmaceuticals as being a sort of paradigm case of this.
I think I can keep talking with this, right?
Yeah.
I think that even the most ardent advocates of product market deregulation would not be for the elimination of patent laws. I think we understand that there's a number of industries in which actually monopoly profits are of the essence. And I think the aim of product market deregulation is to eliminate these profits in the industries in which it is not essential. Now, I think once one has said this, one realizes that exactly how you draw the line between essential and non-essential is far from obvious. There's another remark in that context, which is related but not exactly to the point which I've been thinking about, which is not terribly original, which is I'm not sure we're moving to a world in which monopoly rents are going to be smaller. I think they're actually going to be much bigger. I think that most of the new economy is very much rents because of the zero marginal cost nature of much of the production. But I think it is going to be infinitely harder for the unions to appropriate them, because they come and go much faster. And so although it may well be that in the end we have substantial rents in the economy,
I'm not sure that these are going to be the type of rents that unions are going to be able to get.
The cost of entry is very low in many parts of the new economy.
Right.
So that would go a long way.
Yes. But we know that there are some firms which are doing quite fine in terms of profit in the new economy as well.
I'd like to tip a few shares for us, perhaps. I shall point to somebody in a minute. Somebody pointing to me. Right.
What's been the impact of the internet?
I don't know. and I was looking to see whether Richard Freeman was in the audience, so I could basically pass the question to him, given that he's working on these issues. I cannot believe that it is an important part of the story that I was about, namely Europe. Up to the late 90s. I think that if it is starting to have some macroeconomic effects, and I think it does, this must be something which is true of the US over the last 5 years and is not yet a major macroeconomic issue for any of the European countries just because of the size of the computer sector, which is still much smaller.
There have been some quite interesting estimates by OECD in their June economic outlook, and I think, taking what they call ICT, information communications technology, I think the US has added just under 0.5% to its growth rate right. because of investment in this area. The European economy is a good deal less so far.
Yeah.
Richard, come on, you. Richard Layard, I'm pointing at you. Come on.
No, I was trying to understand.
Is there a microphone?
Overmanning. And how I related to your earlier model, which also seems your earlier model has overmanning relative to the.
The model that I presented formally.
Your first model has employment higher than the firm would choose at the existing wage. There's never such a thing as overmanning in that first model in the sense that productivity is given. So you can't have a situation in which by having too many people you lower productivity. Is that the difference between your earlier model and the remark you were making toward the end, where you had lowered productivity by having too many people?
I was arguing that for purposes of the argument, it didn't matter whether you saw what was happening in the labor market is the outcome of efficient bargaining, in which employment will be higher than the firm would choose if free to choose ex post, and a more in which the firm is forced because of constraints on employment, to have a level of employment which exceeds the point that he would choose on the labor demand curve. I have a deeper question, which is a question to myself, which is we have two models in mind. One is efficient bargaining, in which we think it is efficient to have employment very much to the right of the labor demand curve. And we think of this as rather good. And then we have a model which is seen as generating a very inefficient outcome in which the workers, through all kinds of devious methods, succeed in getting employment above what the firm would like to do. Now, I think from an observational point of view, the two are exactly the same. One sounds efficient, and the other sounds inefficient, but they both have the same outcome. So I think that. But I do not know. We always think of labor hoarding in Europe as a bad thing, I think, for the most part. Not the cyclical part, but the notion that firms had more employment that would have been profit maximizing at the time. I think is generally seen as a bad. And we think of labor shedding, leaving aside the social implications of that, as a good. Maybe this is not right. Maybe this represents a somewhat clumsy attempt to achieve efficient bargaining, with employment being to the right of the labor demand curve. I do not know.
You could perhaps apply this analysis to the 35-hour week in France, where employers are being sort of given incentives to take on extra workers, which is perhaps not the optimal outcome from their point of view. From the point of view of the economy, it might reduce unemployment, and but then there's a cost in terms of social charges being reduced to employers.
I think I'll let you make the case for the 35 hours.
Well, I'm giving you a chance to make the case against it.
Yes.
Right, well, if there are no more questions, yes, right.
In the back.
Good.
So it's just finding it hard to reconcile in my own head the idea of the labour share in total output or whatever in the private sector sort of gone down in recent years, yet coming from a sort of slightly different angle in the growth theory, where human capital is supposed to play a greater role, and you'd sort of imagine that labour would be able to expropriate a greater amount of returns due to their education or whatever. And also the idea in recent years of technology pushing up like wages in certain sectors and so forth, how you could reconcile sort of human capital within the model, maybe. I don't know.
And this is the fact. It raises a question, I think, a statistical question, which is it the case that some of the human capital is now paid in the form of something which would be categorized as capital income, for example, stock options or the rest? And the conclusion here is that although this is happening, this is not changing the trend in any fundamental way. What we see is within the labor share, we see an increase in the share going to skilled workers and a decrease in the share going to unskilled workers. So there's this additional distinction, which I've not focused on, which says that other things equal, it's better to have human capital. Most, another way of saying this from an accounting point of view is in France, the decrease in the labor share is reflected nearly one for one in the decrease of the labor share of the unskilled. This is subject to all kinds of issues about definition of unskilled, but that is a rough statement. So the skilled workers seem to have been more successful at it.
Right, well, if there are no more questions, or let's say some of you are reserving your questions for tomorrow when you've heard the end of the story, which will be obviously a chance to assess the total picture that Olivier is giving us. I would say everybody must come back tomorrow and bring some friends. We've got one or two spare seats in the gallery, because I'm sure we shall be as fascinated by the third lecture as we have been by the first two, and it just remains for me to thank Olivier for his splendid exposition. Thank you.
Thank you.